From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For almost 20 years, Somali writer Nuruddin Farah has been trying to return to his country. In the mid-70s, he was exiled because his writing angered the dictator. And when the dictator later fled, civil war broke out. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nuruddin Farah from his home in Nigeria about the crisis that shouldn't have happened in Somalia. Also today, the dangers of being a kid who likes to read and write in the South Bronx. We talk with Abraham Rodriguez about the neighborhood he grew up in. He wrote his first collection of short stories about it. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Few Good Men, starring Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, and Jack Nicholson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge has thrown out a key charge in the Iran-Contra case against former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan said the second indictment against Weinberger, handed up on October 30th, was invalid because a five-year statute of limitations on the charge has already expired. The indictment accused the former defense secretary of lying to Congress by denying that he'd kept notes of some key meetings on the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra operation. Republicans have claimed that the indictment was timed to link President Bush to the scandal and damage his chances for re-election. Just today, Attorney General William Barr declined to authorize an independent counsel to investigate that allegation. Even as U.S. troops are moving into position in Somalia, there are reports that U.N. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali would like them to stay until warring factions are disarmed and a police force is set up to keep order. The idea could mean an expanded role for the U.S. troops. Barry Schweid reports.
The U.S. mission is to help feed the hungry, and that, by definition, means using force when necessary and also trying to get the feuding warlords to let the relief get through to the people who need it. American diplomat Robert Oakley has been talking to rival leaders in Mogadishu, seeking their cooperation. But still, the U.S. goal is to withdraw the American troops once the relief effort is in good order and to turn peacekeeping over to the U.N. Secretary General Boutros Ghali's request could delay their departure. For instance, disarming the warlords and waiting until a police force is set up could take some time. As a result, the Secretary General's request is not getting an enthusiastic reception within the Bush administration. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The Egyptian government continued its crackdown against Islamic fundamentalists today. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Authorities say 26 suspected Islamic militants were arrested after more than 1,000 police searched three southern Egyptian villages around Asyut province. More than 90 firearms and gunpowder were reportedly confiscated. Police raids are common in that region, considered a major stronghold of militants that aim to overthrow the government and replace it with an Islamic state. Meanwhile, at least 20 more suspects were arrested in the Cairo suburb of Imbaba, another militant hotbed. This is part of a massive security sweep in which about 600 people have been arrested since Tuesday. The government launched a crackdown after militants attacked a group of German tourists in southern Egypt last month. A British tourist is one of the nearly 80 people who've died in extremist-related violence this year. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,304. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR News. The United Nations Security Council voted unanimously today to send at least 700 peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. The UN Infantry Battalion is to be posted along Macedonia's borders with Serbia and Albania in an effort to prevent fighting like that on Serbia's borders with Croatia and Bosnia. Canada has announced it's withdrawing its peacekeeping force from Cyprus next year because of commitments elsewhere and because of the lack of progress between Greek and Turkish Cypriots to reunify their island. As Mike Theodoulou reports from Cyprus, this will place a huge burden on Britain, which has the largest contingent in the UN multinational force.
The UN force here has already been slashed by 30% this year. The Danes are leaving by next week, the Canadians, the second largest contingent, by next September. The UN's operation has been a huge military success, ensuring there's been no bloodshed between Greek and Turkish Cypriots for years. But it's also been a major political failure. The two sides are no closer to reunifying Cyprus, divided since Turkey invaded 18 years ago. The Greek Cypriots are alarmed by the UN reductions, concerned Turkey's 30,000 troops in northern Cyprus will now pose more of a threat. Britain's also worried. It has the largest contingent in the UN's force and doesn't want to bear the whole burden of keeping the peace. Yet, as the former colonial power, Britain says its troops will stay come what may, arguing it has a moral and historical obligation to the island. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
The struggle between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and hardliners in the Russian Congress continued today. After the Congress rejected his nominee for prime minister, Yeltsin said he'd call for a referendum on whether to hold new parliamentary elections or presidential elections or both. Today, the lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to bar a public vote of confidence on any branch of government. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How does the situation in Somalia look to a Somali writer living in exile? Joining us on the phone from Nigeria is one of Somalia's foremost writers, Nuruddin Farah. He was last in his country in 1974, the year one of his novels made dictator Siad Barre so angry he vowed to throw Farah in prison if he ever returned. Farah was studying in London at the time. He's written a trilogy of novels about the dictatorship. They've recently been published in America by Grey Wolf Press. Farah published his first novella in 1965, 7 years before Somalia had a written language of its own. He writes mostly in English. Farah says he'd love to return home to Mogadishu, but not during civil war. Most of his family has escaped from Somalia, but a brother and sister are still in the country. He's been unable to contact them. I asked Farah how he feels as he hears the reports of people starving in his country and foreign troops arriving.
I suppose many people are struck by the generosity of the Americans, struck by the mindfulness of the Americans of what's happening in Somalia. I also suppose that probably this is part of the post-Thanksgiving generosity on the part of a well-fed nation of Americans who, when they sat down to their meals, probably in November, they asked themselves the question, could they continue eating well when 1.5 to 3 million people are dying somewhere in Africa? But I tend to be more cynical than most people. And in my cynicism, and at least when I am in my cynical mood, I tell myself that it is also the very Americans who have somehow are part to blame, because it was their December show in 1991 when the fanfare of television, CNN television and ABC, brought us the war, the Gulf War. Now, it is not a coincidence that a year and a half ago, when Somalia was happening, when it was beginning to get, situation was getting worse and worse, it was the Americans who took the attention of the world from Somalia and who helped the attention of the world in television and media to be focused on what was taking place in the Middle East.
Do you think that, given the way things progressed and how little attention had been paid before, do you think at this point sending in troops was the right thing to do?
There are some people who would disagree with this, but I think this should have happened about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
It should have happened. Not, I didn't expect Americans to be the ones who would go in. I was expecting Africans to be the ones who should be going in. I was expecting the other countries in the Middle East, for example, Somalia is a member of the Arab League, to be the ones who would be looking after the interests of Somalia, in the same way as the Europeans are looking after the interests of Yugoslavia. Because, you know, when you have neighbors, Somalia has been let down not only by its own warlords, Somalia has also been let down by its neighbors, by Ethiopia and Kenya, by Yemen, by all the neighbors who closed their gates to the refugees.
What do you know about the warlords who have been heading up the factions in the civil war? They just declared a truce. But are these people who you know personally at all?
No, I do not know them. No, I have never met them. In my opinion, in fact, their rabies injection are overdue. They should have been given rabies injections, the way mad dogs are. And whereas they're now being treated as respectable persons, and ambassadors and other people are talking to them, and some people are paying homage to them. These are people who've committed murderous crimes against the Somali people. And, you know, Nuremberg trials should also be set up so that Siad Barre, who lives in Nigeria, not very far from where I am now speaking, in Kaduna, he lives about two and a half hours drive from where I live. All these people should be made to pay for the crimes they committed against the innocent women and children, civilians and others.
We in the United States have really been trying to understand Somali culture, and we hear a lot about the clans in Somali culture and what an important cultural unit they represent, and how the elders of the clans are among the most important leaders in Somalia. Can you help us to understand clans a little bit? Maybe you can personalize that for us a little bit and tell us a little bit about your coming of age within a clan and what that meant.
Well, before answering that question in the way you've put it to me, I should perhaps like to relate the question to the issue at hand. That is, how much are the ideas of clan bearing on what is happening in Somalia in the civil war? In other words, what have Aidid and Ali Mahdi, what have they in common with the ideals of the clan? My view is that neither of these persons, in fact, none of the warlords, represent the ideals and the idea of a clan. Now, Aidid and Ali Mahdi are said to belong to the same clan. Now, a clan simply means a lineage into which you are born. It also means that when you are born, your ancestral clan is the one to which or to whom you owe allegiance. Now, if this were the case, then the situation would be a lot simpler. And the reason is because Aidid and Ali Mahdi would both be talked to by the elders of the clan. They would be made to come and explain their positions to someone who has power over their activities. Clans that are neighbors have often known how to deal with each other. And whenever somebody oversteps the mark, the elders of the clan traditionally would sit down together, talk things over, and solve the problem. And whoever seems to have lost either cattle or, you know, a son or a daughter would be given compensation for the loss. And everything would be made peaceful again. Now, this is not a clan warfare, because nowadays, if Aidid or one of his men were to kill somebody, you do not go to the members of the clan to which Aidid is said to belong to. You do not request that they give you recompense for the evils done to you, because they owe no allegiance to the traditional allegiance of the clan. Clans are simply larger family units whose people are said to live in a given area in any country. When 20th century politics and 21-year dictatorship enters the picture, there is no clan. Every dog for himself.
What's left of your clan?
Like every Somali, I too was born into a family. Like every human being, I was born into a family. But I was born in a city, brought up on the ways of the city, and was also brought up not to put any faith in the ideas of the clan. I was brought up to think of myself as a person, as an individual, and as a Somali. And this is what I've always believed in. I do not believe in the ideas of the clan, and do not know, in fact, many of my friends who do.
My guest is exiled Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. He's speaking to us from his home in Nigeria. I'm wondering, you know, we've been all watching TV pictures and photographs of the young men driving those technicals, the jeeps with the guns on them. I'm wondering if you've seen any pictures like that and recognized any of the people, if you've recognized them as the sons of people you knew or anything like that.
I do recognize some of the people who are there, but you see, I also do recognize some of the young people who fled the fighting in Somalia. And the difference, let's say, between the insanity displayed to me by people of my son's generation, my son is 22, 23 now, and I saw him recently when I was in Kenya, and the unreasonableness with which he expresses himself is, in fact, not very, very different from the irrationality displayed by these mad youths who man these technicals. I say this because the only difference is my son hasn't joined one of the warring factions. And let me explain also what one of the reasons why this is so. For 21 years, Somalis have been used to making shortcuts to achieve everything. In other words, there was no morality to speak of, no self-honor, no dignity. Everyone was into corruption. Between one day and the next, the poorest could be made by Siad Barre the wealthiest, and vice versa. In other words, the wealthiest could be made the poorest the following day. And all because Siad Barre was interested in the power greed to continue ruling the country. Now, when young people are brought up on such a wide corruption, when they know the humiliation that their parents go through in order to feed them, in order to clothe them, even young people, wives, daughters and sons, lose respect for the master of the household or for the mistress of the household.
So you feel that when you look at the young men riding around with automatic weapons, that you understand why that's happening?
I understand why that's happening, because what they're actually doing is they're simply copying Siad Barre. Siad Barre came to power through the power of the gun. the warlords are also trying to do the same. Now, these young technicos are on drugs, the majority of them. The majority of them are on drugs brought in from Kenya and Ethiopia. I can also see why, and the reason is because the majority of these people have had no schooling as such. They don't actually come from homes that we would consider to be homes. They come from, roadsides. They are the urchins of the city of Mogadishu. They're the refuse of a city. So naturally, if they're able to get everything because of the guns that they own, then naturally one can understand them.
In our previous interview, you described Somalia's civil war, famine, and dictatorship as manifestations of the same mental disorder, a society that's gone insane. Do you still see it that way?
Yes. You know, to be able to understand what's happening in Somalia, or to be able to understand civil wars, one has to think of twins having a war, twins having a fight. When two people who are closest to each other fall out, poison comes out, and nothing can stop them. And this is when you actually need someone from the outside to come in and to see that such animosity is not visited upon the weaker members of that society.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that's been very confusing for me, anyways, is that Somalia is one of those places in which the fighting isn't about ethnic fighting. It's not a religious war. I mean, the people are of the same language and the same religion, the same background. So it makes the fighting more difficult to understand.
It is more difficult to understand. And when two brothers have a fight, nothing can stop the fight. Nothing. They kill each other. And the reason is because they know each other very well, or they think they know each other very well. And they hurt themselves in such unforgivable fashions that there is no way you can resolve this. Now, it is perhaps, I mean, I suppose one must pay homage to Mr. Oakley, the American envoy, who managed to get these two madmen together. I don't know what language mad people speak. I mean, I do not know. There have been many, many questions that I haven't been able to answer myself. And one of the questions is, what if a nation decides to commit suicide? I mean, the Somali nation seems to have decided to commit suicide. What are the responsibilities of the other nations? And then how much interference can they make? When I was talking to various governments in Africa and Europe, the majority of them kept on saying, we do not want to be accused of interfering in the affairs of another nation. But when the nation is, when the bloodletting of a nation is so savage, what do you do? I mean, do you simply watch it? Do you stand aside and watch people commit suicide? It is very un-Christian, it's very un-Islamic.
Have you lost friends or family to the civil war or to the famine?
Well, two things. One is, I do not know is the honest answer. But I must have also lost a lot more than a friend and family. I've lost. Well, it seems I've misplaced my own pride in my Somaliness. I seem to lose touch with it every now and again. I seem to be unable even to continue writing. I seem to be visited by self-doubts more often than I have ever known myself. to be.
You say it's been hard for you to write. Have you been writing? And if so, what have you been writing about?
I've aborted two novels, I think. I've aborted a novel that I started long before the Civil War began, but it was about the Civil War in Somalia, and aborted it when the reality of the Civil War hit my consciousness. I couldn't simply continue depicting in fiction which was taking place in reality. And so that's two attempts at writing a novel about the Civil War. I've been, of late, spending more and more time on a non-fiction book about refugees, African refugees in Europe. And I think it's easier to continue touching base with my own consciousness when I'm dealing with facts and figures, which I can refer to when sitting in a library in Kituna or in London or in Stockholm. So I've been working on a book about the consequences of a civil war. In other words, civil war gives birth to such horrors that many, many people flee. And when they flee, they do not become human beings. They become refugees.
I guess wherever you travel, there are probably other Africans like you who have been forced to become refugees. I guess you could say that the face of the whole world is changing.
Yes, the face of the whole world is changing. Yes, I was recently in touch with a friend of mine from Bosnia, whom I hadn't seen for very many years. Now, he's also a refugee somewhere in Germany. Some of my friends are refugees somewhere else. But, you know, I think some of us are luckier as refugees than others. You see, because I become no longer a refugee. I'm not a refugee in the sense that I am an exile. See, I'm a writer in exile. It's a more chic to be a writer in exile than to be a stateless refugee whom no one knows. If the truth...
There's a status in it. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I could pick up the telephone if I'm in real trouble, and I would call some of my friends and say, I'm in trouble. I'm at the airport, I'm being held, they're not letting me in. Could you let me in? I'm more and more worried about the people who've become casualties of the civil war in Somalia, and who don't have anyone to telephone, and who are being humiliated and robbed and raped and tortured by Kenyan, Yemeni, and, corrupt officials.
Nuruddin Farah spoke with us from his home in Nigeria. His trilogy about dictatorship has been published in the United States by Grey Wolf. The books are Sweet and Sour Milk, Sardines, and Close Sesame. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Tales of the South Bronx from Abraham Rodriguez. He's written his first collection of short stories. He's always loved to read and write, which are just two of the reasons why he was considered a freak in his neighborhood. His Alice Cooper t-shirt was a third. Lucky for him, he could talk circles around anyone, including the gang members who wanted to beat him up. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Few Good Men, directed by Rob Reiner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A federal judge has thrown out a key charge in the Iran-Contra case against former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Federal Judge Thomas Hogan today dismissed one count of the Weinberger indictment because the judge said it narrowly violated the 5-year statute of limitations. The ruling is considered a setback for Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, but his spokesman said tonight that the ruling had not changed the scope of the remaining 4-count case against Weinberger and that Walsh intends to proceed to trial. The 5th count, which was dismissed today, was filed October 30th and was widely criticized by Republicans who said that it was time to hurt President Bush's re-election chances. Today, Attorney General William Barr refused to seek the appointment of an independent special prosecutor to investigate the timing of the indictment, but he referred the matter to the Justice Department Criminal Division for further investigation. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President-elect Bill Clinton has announced 4 top-level appointments. Clinton has named Robert Reich of Harvard as Labor Secretary and Laura Tyson of the University of California at Berkeley, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He also announced today that he has chosen Wisconsin University Chancellor Donna Shalala to head the Department of Health and Human Services and Carol Browner, Florida's top environmental official, as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. After 2 days of meetings, NATO defense ministers have moved closer to using military force in Bosnia. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
After the meeting in Brussels, NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner said the time has come for military intervention in Bosnia. But he added NATO would only intervene if asked to by the United Nations. The defense ministers expressed concern that with defense budgets being cut across the alliance, the military structure for peacekeeping missions around Europe might be at risk. United States Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, who was attending his last NATO meeting, offered a critical assessment of NATO's future. He said the alliance must build closer ties with former Warsaw Pact countries and questioned whether NATO could survive long term if it was not more active in helping those countries. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The government says that the start of the holiday season helped push up sales a bit last month. The Commerce Department says that sales in the month of November were up 0.4% compared to the same time 1 year ago. The government also revised sales upward in October, saying that they rose a strong 1.9% compared to the 0.9% estimated earlier. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 8 points to close at 3,304.8 on volume of more than 164 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. In Moscow, a fight continues between Russia's hardline parliament and President Boris Yeltsin. The Russian leader has called for a nationwide vote on new elections, but lawmakers voted by a very wide margin to bar a public vote of confidence in any branch of government. The law would also stop a disbanding of government bodies before their terms end. The power struggle centers on Yeltsin's move toward market changes, along with the powers of the president and the Russian Congress. There has been widespread discontent over hardships linked to Yeltsin's reforms, including a very high inflation rate and a 25% drop in Russian production. 2 of Somalia's most powerful warlords agreed to a ceasefire today for the capital, which is scheduled to go into effect in 48 hours. Despite the truce, NPR's Sunni Khalid reports that there are signs that rival forces may be preparing to renew hostilities in the future.
Bush administration officials say there are indications that forces loyal to General Mohammed Farah Aidid and Ali Mahdi Mohammed have begun to stockpile weapons and ammunition around Somalia's capital of Mogadishu. U.S. officials added that the rival warlords, who have been battling each other for control of the capital for 18 months, may be preparing to renew their conflict after U.S. forces withdraw from Somalia. Despite these concerns, U.S. diplomats and private relief agencies hailed today's ceasefire between Somalia's two most powerful warlords, and they expressed hope that supplies of humanitarian aid would begin to reach famine victims in outlying regions. Meanwhile, factional fighting continued in several regions of Somalia as U.S. forces prepared to move from Mogadishu to the inland town of Baidoa this weekend. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
High winds and rain along the East Coast disrupted activity on financial markets today. Many traders were not able to get to work because of train cancellations and bus delays, and trading in U.S. Treasuries ended 4 hours early. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Urban youth culture has a literary language, but it's usually rap music, not literature. My guest, Abraham Rodriguez, is trying to get that urban sound on the page. He's lived in the South Bronx all his life, and now he's writing about the people he grew up with. Many of them got hooked on drugs early and became teenage parents. Some of them are already dead. Rodriguez has been writing since he was a kid. He's won several short story awards, and his first collection, The Boy Without a Flag, was recently published. The first story is autobiographical, about a Puerto Rican-American boy who refuses to salute the flag. But the rest of the stories are about the kids he says most people see as the enemy. The story Babies is about a 16-year-old girl who's just found out she's pregnant. She's also a heroin addict, as is the guy she's living with. The story is about how she reevaluates her life and decides whether or not to have the baby. This is Abraham Rodriguez reading an excerpt of Babies. This passage contains some street language.
I hate it when people say I'm a junkie and shit, 'cause it's really not true. I know I got it all under control, and plus I know I can stop anytime I want. I did once, for 3 whole days. And then, since I knew I could take it or leave it, I took it. 'Cause, I mean, what else is there? Why shouldn't I feel sweet? Some Hispano been asking me where I picked up such a habit. 'Cause around 149th, there ain't no 16-year-old girls on H. The fact is, I used to hang out in the village with this funky guy named Matt who used to do crazy stuff, like steal cars for a day just to ride around. I met him through a friend in junior high. Me and him used to hang out a lot in that park with the big white arch thing where he used to deal H to all the junkies who hung there. I asked him what it was like to take H, 'cause I seen him sniffing it, and he gave me a book to read, Christian F. I read like 4 pages and said, to hell with that, I hate books. He got mad and said I should learn something. But I wouldn't go near it again, so he says, screw it, I should learn the hard way then. He shot me full of H. I felt like I was gonna throw up on him. My stomach was dribbling around, and my head felt like it was separating from my body. I got real nervous until Matt told me to relax and not be uptight, and then I started feeling real good. The next day he shot me up again and made a joke about that being my last free sample. When that freeze hit me, I was on cloud 9, 10, 11. I was free of everything that bugged my head out, like my mother, who was out screwing like a dog in heat, or my bad grades in school, or my older brother, who one day disappeared without even a poof, leaving only a pair of Pro-Keds on the kitchen table as a goodbye. Nah, I wasn't thinking about nothing at all, just getting more sweet H and taking more trips into that sweet nothing land. I had to keep shooting after that. One time I bought some real bad shit from some guy I didn't know, a freaking Latin dude, and it was awful. I felt like if bugs were crawling all over and I couldn't stop scratching. That was the only time I ever got whacked. That was about a year ago that I turned on, I mean. And since then, I haven't gotten the sunken face or the bags under the eyes or the circles, neither. I look great. In fact, guys keep asking me out all the time, but I got my smiley, so I say nah. I'd only be like my mother if I said yeah.
You really read well. You're a performer too, aren't you?
No. you know, you grow up around it, so you're just able to turn it on, you know.
Is this story based on someone who you know?
Yeah, I've known girls like this. I've known people like this. A lot of the people in the book are based on real people, real kids, really. They're all kids, you know. So they're not like, you know, really old people, experienced, but just sort of discovering this kind of thing for the first time, which makes it all the more tragic, I think.
You grew up in the South Bronx. Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
It's pretty much the same kind of neighborhood I live in now. I still live in the Bronx. You know, when I was growing up, when I was very young, there were just a lot of people, a lot of kids, a lot of families, you know, rows of tenements, and it was more of a community when I was growing up. Sometime in the 70s, they started burning everything. Everything started going. And then we had just, like, lots of abandoned buildings and empty lots and the usual sort of ghetto kind of thing, which a lot of people feel is cliche, but which is still going on, you know, the junkies and the drug addicts. And of course, when I was growing up, we had, you know, gangs. We had street gangs like the Savage Skulls and the Spanish Mafia and the Dirty Dozen and these kind of things. You know, the cats would have these little Lee jackets with the insignia on the back and all this corny stuff. And now we don't have that. Now what we have is, I guess, a little worse, which is just posses, which are, you know, groups of young kids who run around and usually heavily armed and probably three times more dangerous than when I was growing up. But it's pretty much the same burg. It's the same kind of experience. You got the same kind of wasted lives. You got the same kind of people out there on the streets doing the same kind of hustling, the same kind of criminal activity, the same kind of hurt, the same kind of pain. You know, it's just the same thing, you know. And you got your people in the midst of all of that who are honest, you know, God-fearing, hard-working poor people who are just trying to, like, bring up their kids so they don't end up that way, you know. Same old story.
What was your family like when you were growing up? Was your family together? Were both of your parents around?
Yeah, my family's pretty tight-knit. I mean, you know, we're still together pretty much except for my sister because she got married. But very tight-knit family, very supportive parents. I was kind of a spoiled kid, you know, always at home. I didn't hang out on the street very much. I was always into books and the Beatles. So I sort of grew up in my house, you know, for a long time because I grew up in love with books and writing. You know, my father got me into writing because he was a poet and used to type a lot. This was the first sound I remember hearing when I was little. That's part of the whole Boy Without a Flag thing, you know, hearing the typewriter and really liking that sound. You know, my father used to use typewriters, big ones, used to rent them. And I just love that sound, you know, and I started typing. I just had to sit on his lap and type some. And then I just liked it so much that, you know, eventually I begged and pleaded for portable. And then I started bashing out my own kind of stories and things. But that was like when I was really little, like, you know, 10 or 11 years old. It's just a typewriter fixation, really. It's really all about typewriters, this whole thing. You know?
It's like your instrument.
Yeah, I just love them. I just love typewriters and manuals, mind you, not the electric stuff.
My guest is Abraham Rodriguez. His first collection of short stories, The Boy Without a Flag, has just been published. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Abraham Rodriguez about his new collection of short stories. What was it like for you growing up, loving to read, loving to write, listening to the Beatles in the South Bronx, where I think people were much more kind of physical, being tough probably
yeah.
was very important. I'm sure reading was considered pretty unimportant as a survival skill in your neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, I was pretty much a freak when I was growing up in the sense of, you know, see, like, for example, back then, you know, the early 70s, you know, rock and roll wasn't like it is now, where, you know, you have Hispanics like rock and roll and everybody likes rock and roll. Rock and roll means like 8 million different things. You know, back then, rock and roll was white music, it was honky music. You didn't like rock and roll. If you were growing up in the South Bronx, you know, that wasn't your scene. Well, I loved rock and roll. I was into rock music, so I was a rock freak. Okay, I had the torn jeans, my hair was too long, I liked the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the whole thing. You know, Alice Cooper t-shirts. I mean, I was really out of I was really out of my element, all right? I was really, really asking for trouble. And then, on top of that, I liked books. All right, that's the worst. I mean, okay, you have no taste in music, fine. Okay, we can live with that. But then you're like reading and stuff, is always walking around with books and stuff. The first book that I read cover to cover was William L. Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Okay, come on, the kid must be cracked. All right, even my teachers thought I was strange. You know, they were like, wow, this kid reads books. You know, you gotta be cool around him, you know. So I was always an outsider in that sense, and that got worse as I got older. I mean, because, you know, in the sense of, you know, I read, I talked differently than other kids. Kids used to say, well, you know, I'm Jewish because, you know, my name's Abraham Rodriguez, and because I use $10 words, and because I talk with my hands. You can't see my hands, right, but they're moving. And they say, you know, well, Jews talk with their hands. And look at his nose. He's got a big nose. And, you know, so I was like a Jewish kid growing up, really. Even though I'm not Jewish, they used to think, oh, you know, he's this Jew guy, Jew freak. And, you know, I mean, I started reading Philip Roth, you know, because it's true. I started reading Philip Roth, you know, all those parts in Philip Roth where he's saying, I was measuring my nose up against the table, you know, to see how long it was. And I'm doing the Jewish test, you know, because I'm saying, like, is it me? You know, it's a sort of identity crisis there that I went through with Philip Roth because, you know, he's the first real fiction I ever read because I was just reading history books and stuff. But, you know, I had a real identity kind of crisis thing. I didn't feel very Latin in that sense, and I grew up that way for a long time. I was pretty much alone, so books and records were really, really, you know, I used to hang out with books and records. That's how I grew up. And girlfriends. I had a lot of girlfriends, but not girlfriends like, yo, man, that's a fine fox. It was more like, you know, she's my friend. She come over to me, hey, Orlando hit me, you know, and I'm like, oh, why'd he do that? You know, you should find somebody that won't hit you. She's like, I love him. You know, it's this kind of thing. So I was a best friend. You know, I patted down her tears. I gave her a hug. Yeah, go back to him, you know. Next time, don't tell him he's a fool. You know, it's this kind of thing. So, you know, that's where a lot of the stories come from, me hanging with these incredible girls. I mean, I knew a lot of incredible girls, you know, as friends. We weren't, like, involved.
So when you were a teenager and people were supposed to kind of be able to physically defend themselves and everything, what did you do?
Oh, well, I was smart. See, I could talk my way out of fights. I knew people who wanted to kick my butt, but, you know, I could talk my way around them. I mean, words were my thing, you know. So I could talk my way. I must have talked my way out of like 30 or 40 big major scrapes.
Is there one you can think of that you could tell us about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew this kid called Nelson who's I don't know where he is now, God bless him, but he used to be in the Savage Skulls, you know, and he didn't like me. He didn't like me for a long time. I don't exactly remember what it was that got him to really despise me. It could have been the Alice Cooper t-shirt. I remember that pissed him off. But, you know, he cornered me one day in the lockers downstairs, like in the basement where they had the cafeteria. And he says, like, I'm going to, you know, I can't say what he said. But he was going to do it, I swear, because he, you know, once he said that, you knew he was going to do it. And so after school, you know, we all got together outside for this beating. You know, I'm sure they sold tickets and stuff. There's a little waiting line and everything. And he was going to beat the hell out of me, but I talked him out of it. I just told him, look, you know, let's be honest about this, you know. Okay, me, I'm just a wimp. You can kick my butt, you know. And I just talked him out of it. I started talking about friendship and life and I don't know. I even mentioned Hitler at one point, you know, Poland. I brought everything in, you know, because I could just talk circles around them. The guy's waiting for me. This was his mistake. He was waiting for me to finish. So he's like, yeah, that's true. All right, you finished yet? I'm like, no, because that's the preamble. And then I just go on into, you know. So finally he just, like, you know, we ended up shaking hands and all this. Because we started talking, I don't know how we got into English and stuff. But then I started saying, well, you know. You know, I was talking to the teacher and she says, well, you know, your English isn't that good. And he's like, yeah, I know. I got an F on my report. And so I say, well, look, man, look, I'll help you with the report. That's no problem. You know, I can help you with that crap. It's easy. Believe me. And so I ended up helping him out. You know, I ended up hanging with some savage skull guy because I could help him with English. So, you know, I found ways around it. You know, the whole macho thing and having to beat people up and all this and show your manhood. I sort of found other ways around it, you know. I didn't need into the whole thing, really. I just wanted to not get beaten up. But it wasn't that heavy for me. I don't know why, but, you know, I wasn't confronted with that kind of scene that much. And, I mean, I'm probably playing it up more because I want to seem, like, real gutsy. But it really wasn't that bad. I mean, I never really, of all the fights I could have been in, I figure maybe one or two were, like, really serious. Mm-hmm. Everything else was just, you know, school kid kind of crap.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Like, you say that you talk differently from most of the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Most of your stories, which are about other people, are really written in the kind of street language that you don't necessarily speak yourself. But I guess you were listening the whole time that you weren't speaking that way yourself.
Yeah,
and really picked up on it as a writer.
That's the prudential. That's the piece of the rock right there. Yeah, you know, you're always soaking stuff in. You know, when I finally got to college, I remember I was still writing. I wrote a lot about Germans and World War II and, you know, stories of the Eastern Front. This collection should be stories of the Eastern Front. You know, I was infatuated with German soldiers and all this. And when I got to college, the first story that I won an award with was a story about a German sniper behind enemy lines. I remember meeting Ed Rivera, who's a Hispanic writer and probably my mentor, I guess, because I got a lot from him when I was there. And he told me, look, you know, I had written Elba at that time, and I think Babies was already written. And he read some of it and he said, look, you know, you should really write more about what you know about. You know, I mean, the Eastern Front is fine and everything, but come home. You know, it's basically come home from the Eastern Front because the stories are all around you and you can write them. You know, these stories that you wrote now, you know, you capture it. You can write it. You should look around you. And at that point, I started to really think more about what I had in the South Bronx and the stories that there were in the South Bronx and how the stories were not being told. You know, there was nobody writing them.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. It was an honor.
Abraham Rodriguez, his book of short stories is called The Boy Without a Flag. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on President-elect Clinton's new cabinet appointments?
Well, we'll have the news of his announcement from Little Rock today of four appointments, two actual cabinet secretaries, head of the EPA and head of his Council of Economic Advisors, with special pieces about Donna Shalala, who's going to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, now Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, and also Carol Browner, who's been named to head the EPA. Also on today's program, African-American special perspective on the U.S. action in Somalia. And do you recall Penn & Teller, Penn Jillette's book, How to Play with Your Food?
Sure did.
Talked about it quite a bit on our program. Well, now you have to recall it because of something defective that they put out with the book. It's being recalled. Penn Jillette makes amends.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Even before Aaron Sorkin's play A Few Good Men opened on Broadway in 1989, film producer David Brown had decided it was going to be a big movie. He bought the rights on the basis of the first draft alone. 3 years later, it's a very major motion picture with Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, and Jack Nicholson, directed by Rob Reiner, whose last two movies were When Harry Met Sally and Misery. Is A Few Good Men worthy of the Oscar nominations everyone predicts? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to find out.
The nominations are a sure bet, and the box office take is certain to be hefty, but I can't work up much affection for A Few Good Men. Rob Reiner's a very proficient director. It's amazing how much military spit and polish he brings to Aaron Sorkin's script, which is clearly suffering from gunmetal fatigue. But how exciting can a movie be without a single unpredictable moment? Even if you hadn't seen the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial, which is what A Few Good Men is so desperately trying to be, this material would still look worn. It's Perry Mason in a uniform. The setting is Washington, where young Navy lawyer Daniel Caffey, played by Tom Cruise, has just been assigned to a new case. At America's base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a young Marine has been punished by two other Marines for breaking the chain of command. Somehow, the discipline has gotten out of hand, and now the victim is dead, and his attackers are accused of murder. Cruise's character is a lackadaisical hotshot who's famous for his ability to plea bargain. In fact, he's never seen the inside of a courtroom. But the internal affairs lawyer assigned to the case, played by Demi Moore, won't let him shrug this one off.
Lieutenant, this letter makes it look like your client had a motive to kill Santiago.
Gotcha. And Santiago is who?
The victim.
Write that down. Am I correct in assuming that these letters don't paint a flattering picture of Marine Corps life at Guantanamo Bay?
Yes,
and am I further right in assuming that a protracted investigation of this incident might cause some embarrassment for the Security Council guy?
Colonel Jessup,
but... 12 years.
I'm sorry?
I'll get them to drop the conspiracy and conduct unbecoming. 12 years.
You haven't talked to a witness or looked at a piece of paper.
Pretty impressive, huh?
You're going to have to go deeper than that.
Commander, do you have some sort of jurisdiction here that I should know about?
My job is to make sure that you do your job. I'm special counsel for internal affairs, so my jurisdiction's pretty much in your face.
Cruise and Moore spend most of the movie struggling to get their mouths around Sorkin's sometimes long-winded dialogue. Mostly Cruise manages and Moore wipes out. Her performance is of the, hey, let's give the homecoming queen a part in the school play variety. And she's done something really scary with her hair. I think the style's called Shepherd's Pie. Tom Cruise does what he always does, which is to say he starts out seeming so juvenile and awkward that you can't believe you're going to actually watch him pretend to be a grown-up for 2 hours. And then, like all his characters, he develops from a boy into a man before your eyes. As Lieutenant Caffey gets serious about the case and acquires the courage of his convictions, Cruise expands too. He'll never have much range or subtlety, but he has a lot of presence and a lot of charm. He has to, because the man he's going up against in this movie is Jack Nicholson. As the commanding officer down at Guantanamo Bay, Nicholson dispels whatever counterfeit suspense the movie might have had from the moment you see him. This crew-cut, cigar-chomping bulldog is an instant villain, so much larger than life that if he were to appear in more than 3 scenes, he'd swamp the film. Still, you have to admire Jack's discipline here. He manages to exude the usual Nicholsonian evil while actually keeping his eyebrows down somewhere in the region of his eyes. Besides, I loved watching him bellow and sneer. You could say his performance is too juicy. You could say, in fact, it's pure dripping ham. But hey, when the plot is this rusty, you need the grease.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistants from Penny Nelson. Today we say goodbye to our intern extraordinaire, Kezia Perlman. We wish we could keep her, but she's returning to Kalamazoo College. We wish her good luck. We'll miss you, Kezia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, human rights and ethnic violence. We talk to Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch. The group has just issued its annual report. It says that ethnic violence is fueled more by human rights abuses than by historic animosities. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.